Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Germany gave the global economy some good news today. We will tell you why it didn't really matter all that much. We'll have our weekly wrap, and Harry Potter goes to Orlando, Florida, bringing with him really, really long lines. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to strengthen America by empowering young people to achieve educational success beyond high school. And by Yellow Book 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, today the 13th of August. But it's good to have you here anyway. It has been more than 20 years since the Germans reported economic numbers like they did today. They doubled predictions of growth in gross domestic product, and they did it in a way that a lot of countries, including this one, by the way, can only dream of, exporting its way out of trouble. Still, that wasn't enough to satisfy everybody. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard explains.
Not since the fall of the Berlin Wall has the German economy done better. Between April and June, output grew by 2.2%. That's three times faster than France, 10 times faster than Spain. And don't even think of comparing it with Greece. The reason, says Andrew Hilton of the CSFI think tank, is Germany's exporting overdrive.
It really looks as though the German export machine has been cranked up to its top volume, and it is pumping out Mercedes and Volkswagens for the rest of the world.
And particularly to Asia and Latin America. Germany's been helped recently by a weaker euro, but, says analyst Charles Dumas, it's also helped itself by keeping its prices competitive.
The German growth has been achieved by repression of wages, which has made them more competitive, but of course has also meant that consumer spending has hardly increased in the whole of the last decade.
And that's why Germany's been taking some flak today, because it's selling and not buying. Its relative reluctance to import doesn't help other countries export their way out of trouble. Philip White is with the Centre for European Reform.
What we need now is for Germany to take over the mantle from countries like Britain and the United States, and for German consumers to start spending more than they've been doing in the recent past.
He's urging the Germans to throw open their wallets and become a bit more like free-spending Americans. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
President Obama signed a border security spending bill today, a cool $600 million to put more agents and equipment on the job along the Mexican border. Given the state of the federal government's bank balance, though, that is deeply in the red, you might wonder where the money is going to come from. Well, says the White House, from taxes on a very different kind of immigration, H-1B visas, the ones for skilled workers. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
The plan will make it more expensive for certain companies to get H-1Bs. Those are the visas for skilled workers.
It's clearly not going to pay for the majority of the border funding that's being called for in the new bill.
Lindsay Lowell is an expert on international migration at Georgetown University.
The number of companies affected isn't really known, and the number of H-1Bs that they employ is not always known. But one suspects, and I think all the evidence points to, a rather small number of firms being actually affected.
Lowell says that at any given moment, between 400,000 and 600,000 workers in the U.S. have H-1B visas. But this tax will only apply to companies where more than half the employees are H-1B holders. In other words, it won't affect the big tech firms. What it will hit are the so-called body shops. These are mostly Indian companies that provide outsourced workers to American employers to write software, for example. but it could have larger consequences for U.S.-India trade relations. Jagdish Bhagwati is a professor at Columbia and an expert on globalization. He says American companies have been trying to negotiate all kinds of deals in India.
So large numbers of these transactions are at stake, and I think India has been opening up. But when it sees something like this happening at our end, that's going to provoke retaliation.
He says this move makes it look like we're becoming more protectionist, something which could make India less inclined to let Americans do business there. In New York, I'm Alisa Roth for Marketplace.
Over to the media beat here for a little bit. There are some newspapers around the country that have gone completely digital, dropping the paper part altogether. Most of them, though, still hold to the hybrid model, a printed copy that lands on your doorstep every morning for a fee, and a free version online. There have been some hints that the iPad might change that dynamic. Early users do seem to be willing to pay for news online. And that is music to Rupert Murdoch's ears. The CEO of News Corp and the owner of The Wall Street Journal has plans to breathe life into the newspaper business with a digital newspaper made just for tablet computers. Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
News Corp's Rupert Murdoch gushed about the iPad to an audience at the National Press Club back in April.
You know, I've got a glimpse of the future with the iPad. It is a wonderful thing. It may well be, you know, the saving of the newspaper industry.
Well, I think it's a bit early to declare that.
That's Marissa Gluck reacting to Murdoch. She's managing partner at media consulting firm Radar Research. Gluck says the industry's been so beaten down by digital technology, it's desperate for a savior, but it's too early to tell if the iPad will be it.
We're talking about a consumer behavior that is still evolving. We don't know what consumers are willing to pay for newspapers on their iPad. We don't know what newspapers should charge advertisers for being on the iPad.
Whatever the cost, everyone seems to crave the iPad's touchscreen technology. Apple sold 3 million tablets in 80 days. The LA Times reports that Murdoch's national tablet paper will hire several dozen reporters and editors. A News Corp spokesman said the company would not comment. Journalism professor Chris Rausch at the University of North Carolina says iPad papers may help the industry recoup revenue lost to online content.
Murdoch starting an iPad-only paper is not going to solve all of our problems, but if everybody gets behind it and does it, then I think we might have something.
And he says it would eliminate a newspaper's single biggest expense, the paper it's printed on. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
The week on Wall Street has come to a merciful end. At least today was relatively painless. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, so I didn't know until I started getting ready for the broadcast today that should you so desire, you can now get lip gloss and handbags and yoga mats, all themed around the new Julia Roberts movie that opens today. Eat, Pray, Love is the story about one woman's quest to declutter her life, a quest that has turned into a merchandising bonanza, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
I used to have this appetite for my life, and it is just gone. I want to go someplace where I can marvel at something.
Like the Eat, Pray, Love laptop from Sony, or the Eat, Pray, Love prayer beads from Cost Plus, or the Four Seasons Eat, Pray, Love travel package, or the 400 Eat, Pray, Love products available on the HSN shopping channel.
It was a real significant opportunity to be involved in a movie that we know that our female audience is going to be very interested in.
That's HSN marketing executive Bill Brand. The network just wrapped up a three-day Eat, Pray, Love-a-palooza.
Lancome created an Eat, Pray, Love collection exclusively for us. They loved Ferrara's cannolis. On the jewelry front, this charm with an Eat, a Pray, and a Love on it was also a very popular item.
It's so the Oprah crowd. Oh, my gosh.
Mary Lou Quinlan is the CEO of marketing firm Just Ask a Woman. She also lives in the same town as Eat, Pray, Love author Elizabeth Gilbert.
I see the face of the women. They come to her as if it's Mecca. And affectionately, around here, they're called lesbians.
Quinlan says Eat, Pray, Love has tapped into many desires women have. The desire for self-exploration, for love, for carbs. But consumed author Andrew Bennett says it isn't just a girl thing.
You look at, you know, the growth of things like organic or hybrid. What we see is a shift towards much more mindful consumption, away from mindless consumption.
Bennett says Eat, Pray, Love taps into something the whole culture has been moving towards.
It talks about finding your inner self and spirituality and enjoying life's simple pleasures.
Like drinking Eat, Pray, Love tea out of an Eat, Pray, Love teacup in your Eat, Pray, Love tunic on your Eat, Pray, Love Malay Queen bed. What could be simpler? I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Let's see now. The stock market this week, lousy. Corporate profits, not so bad. General consumer mood, eh. But the real economic news of the week came a couple of days ago, and that is where we're going to start our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond. Here to help us do that are John Carney from CNBC and Felix Salmon from Reuters. Good to talk to you both again.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
So, Felix, I guess we'll start with you. We're going to go back to Tuesday afternoon, about 2:15 or so East Coast time, and the Fed's announcement that, oh my gosh, the economy is, in fact, still stalling. Are you surprised at all?
No, I was kind of expecting this. I think most people were. The market did react a bit, which proves that it wasn't entirely priced in. But the fact is that the stimulus money seems to be running out a bit. The recovery seems to be running out of steam. And we needed some indication from the Fed that they were paying attention to this and were going to react somehow.
Are you happy with what they've decided to do? Take some of the money they've got already in the bond market and the housing markets and keep rolling it over?
Am I happy with it? I think it's a signal. I think basically they've run out of bullets at this point. There's not all that much they could do in practice. So what they can do is they can make noises and signal to the markets that they are still worried and they still feel that they should be doing something. And this is basically all they can feel comfortable doing right now.
John Carney, you think the Fed's making the right kinds of noises, to steal a line from our friend Felix?
I think it's good that they're acknowledging the reality that the economy has not improved as much as they thought it should have by now. But it's troubling to me to see that they really don't have a lot of new ideas. Everybody used to praise Bernanke for the creativity with which he was employing the monetary policy to go beyond the zero bound range for interest rates. But this move sort of showed that he's kind of out of ideas right now.
All right, well, hold on a second. So put up or shut up. What can he do? What do you want him to do?
I don't think there's actually a lot he can do.
Never mind then? Is that what that was?
I don't have a lot of ideas either. I think what the Fed should do is allow the economy to sputter a bit. That's harsh medicine, but they shouldn't pretend that they can just, you know, fiddle with a couple knobs and set the economy back on course.
All right. So, Felix, we're going to talk about the bond market a little bit later on in the program. We're going to talk about mortgage rates. But I want to, since you are a bond guy, I want you to look at the 10-year note. It's down at like 2.7%, the yield is. And explain to us what that tells us about the economy, which way the bond market thinks the economy is going.
Well, one thing it certainly says is that absolutely nobody is worried about inflation. Anyone who claims to be worried about inflation, all they need to do is look at the yield on that 10-year note, and there's no inflation priced in there at all. So the worrying thing about that yield is that it's not what we saw last time yields were this low, which is the flight to quality trade. Everyone's so scared of all other assets that they just simply buy treasuries. Instead, what we're seeing is fear of deflation to a certain degree, and a kind of just unhappiness. People are just like, I just want something relatively safe to put my money in, be able to sleep well at night, even if I'm not going to get any returns.
So, John, if we're not worried about inflation, as Felix said we are, what are you worried about?
I think what we're worried about is a protracted economic downturn, not a, you know, precipitous drop where, you know, we wake up one morning and unemployment is 25%, but that we have a 9 to 12% unemployment rate that continues for several years. years that the economy does not pick up. You know, everybody thought, you know, oh, the Fed will tighten sometime in the last half of 2010 or in the beginning of 2011. That's pretty much off the table now. We are looking at a long, protracted downturn, and all the economic indicators are telling us exactly that.
Felix, give us some sunshine on the way out, man. Come on.
We can't have a double-dip recession because we never came out of the first one.
All right, you're officially fired. Felix Sevin from Reuters. John Carney from CNBC. We'll talk to you guys later.
Thanks, Guy.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up.
I'm sure that at its height, that line was probably approaching a mile long.
A case study on money making and crowd control. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial shaved off another 16 points today, about a 10%, closed at 10,303. The NASDAQ also lost 16 points. That is 0.75% on that particular index. Ended things at 2173, did the NASDAQ. The S&P 500 dropped 4 points, 0.4%. Finished at 1,079. For the week gone by, the Dow off 3.3%. The NASDAQ unplugged 5%. The S&P 500 slid 3.8%. Bank of America was one of the winners today, rising 1.25%. Overall, financials were mixed, though. For-profit colleges got schooled today in anticipation of more government oversight of student loans. ITT Educational Services dropped 7%. DeVry was downgraded 5.75% today. Not a good day for retailers. Nordstrom disrobed more than 7%. JCPenney unzipped more than 4.5%. That after they issued some disappointing quarterly outlooks. Eli Lilly shot down 2.5% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.67%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at massmutual.com/mutuality. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The National Association of Home Builders releases its monthly report on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. NASA convenes its first IT summit. Agenda topics focus on collaboration, social networking, and IT security and privacy, among other things. And he wore the number 3 on his uniform. Baseball Hall of Famer Babe Ruth died on August 16, 1948. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and I am not, contrary to what you're about to hear, a paid spokesman for the National Realtors Association. But if you can afford it, and if it makes sense for you, there might never be a better time to buy a house. 30-year fixed-rate mortgages today are going for less than 4.5%. That is practically free money. And yet, the housing industry is still stuck. To find out why and to find out what it all means, we've got Tess Vigeland here with us. She's the host of our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. Hey, Tess.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so mortgage rates at historic lows the past couple of months. Good thing, yes?
Well, for homeowners, on the face of it, it certainly is an incredible opportunity. But people are not taking advantage of it.
I hate it when you say that.
Yeah, you knew there was a bet coming. You know, I think a lot of people are just still very unsure about what's happening in the economy and in the stock market. We talked actually with quite a few realtors from across the country a couple of weeks ago, and what they told us is actually that these interest rates are not playing in to people's decisions of whether they're going to go out and buy a house. What is playing in is whether they feel good about the economy or whether they don't. And if they do, then they're going to be out at the open houses. If they don't, then they're worried about whether their job is safe. And you're certainly not going to go out and make the biggest purchase of your life if you're not feeling comfortable about the world.
When rates go down, you can afford more house. Is this affecting home prices at all?
It is, actually. A few months ago, you kind of started to hear that we had hit bottom in the home prices. And in some of the hardest hit housing markets, including here in L.A., prices were starting to go up again. That coincided with the end of the home buyer tax credit. So folks thought, hey, you know, I better jump in. This was around March, April. Mm-hmm. Now, yet again, with talk of a lot more pain to come in the economy, they're thinking, hey, maybe prices are going to go down again. Yeah. Maybe there's another floor to hit.
We were talking before we went on the air, and you mentioned that something like 3/4 of all the mortgage applications that are out there are refis, right? Are people refinancing their mortgages. Who are they? I mean, where does that play in?
Well, you have people who are refinancing who are in really good shape with their mortgages, no chance of foreclosure or anything like that. They're just looking to take advantage of lower interest rates. Then you have folks who are trying to perhaps get out of some of those funky mortgages that they were given a few years ago, interest only, 5-1 ARMs, that sort of thing. But I put in a call to the Mortgage Bankers Association to figure out which of these was more prevalent.
Right.
And they said actually that most of the people refinancing now are simply borrowers looking to take advantage of these low interest rates. Anyone who wanted to get out of one of those strange mortgages before has kind of already done that, because actually rates have been very low for about a year.
Okay, so let me ask you the existential question here. It sounds like a lot of what people are trying to do is what people sometimes try to do with the equity markets, right? They try to time it. And they try to say, oh, here's what's going to happen. This is going to happen. And then I'm going to jump in. That never works.
It never works. And, you know, if you're waiting for prices to hit absolute bottom, number one, you're not going to know that until after it happens, right? And number two, you can get a mortgage now for 4.5% if you have a down payment, good credit score, and money for all the costs that come along with owning a house. What more timing do you need?
Tess Figland, she hosts our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. Tess, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Guy.
An amazing thing happened at Universal Studios Orlando during the second quarter of the year. The theme park reported its first bump in attendance in 2 years. It then promptly raised ticket prices, but that's not the story we've got for you today. What we've got is the why. Why more people are schlepping to Central Florida to be separated from their hard-earned dollars. And more importantly, what happens once they get there. From Orlando, Katie Ball has more.
I need to make a confession. I live in Orlando, and I don't do theme parks. I'm claustrophobic, so the crowds, not my thing. But then Harry Potter came to town, and like the rest of the world, I couldn't wait.
Oh boy, you can get in, but you can't move. Holy moly.
It's been 2 months since Universal opened the Wizarding World of Harry Potter, and people are still coming in droves. Robert Niles is the editor of Theme Park Insider, and he actually braved opening day.
Well, I knew it was going to be an unusual day when I showed up 3 hours before the park was supposed to open, and the air was just littered with news helicopters hovering over the area. I'm sure that at its height, that line was probably approaching a mile long.
John DeHaas is an avid theme parker who's been several times since opening, and when he went to buy a souvenir butterbeer mug, an employee said they had gone through their 2-year supply in 2 weeks.
I'm sure they're thrilled that the crowds are there, but I think they were just really blindsided by how intense people would be about this and how many people would show up in the crowds and the lines. And it's just, I've never seen anything like this.
No matter how busy, people keep coming back to the Wizarding World. And Universal's had to come up with some crowd control solutions on the fly, like a mile-long aisle made out of masking tape, to temporary signs deliberately sending people the long way around the park. Small stuff, according to Robert Niles.
The only shortcoming that I would give them is that they didn't have some type of fairly, you know, intricately designed special queue area with entertainment, but that's, you know, asking for a lot.
But no detail was spared in the attraction itself. Narrow cobbled streets, low-beamed ceilings. The design is way more authentic than regular theme park fare.
It's not like you're in some type of blown up cartoon approximation of Harry's world. They took a longer view of it and say, you know, there needs to be some intimacy with this. And if that means longer lines up front, I think the trade-off there is it's going to be a more enduring attraction for people in the years to come.
Even now, in 95-degree heat, it's pretty awesome to see the looks on people's faces. Yeah, some have the standing-in-line glazed look and have wondered aloud if it's all worth it. But for the most part, the guests are thrilled.
It was brilliant. I'm sure it's just as J.K. Rowling must have thought it was. It was absolutely, you know, just as per the books.
The Wizarding World of Harry Potter is habit-forming. My buddy Seth actually goes in a couple of times a week to ride a ride and have a butterbeer. And when I asked Universal what they're doing to deal with the crowds, they said they've made changes to make wait times an hour or less. I figure if Harry Potter's giving Universal a few growing pains, it's a small price for making it all so good. And this is from me, a confirmed anti-Parker. Well, reformed anti-Parker. Yeah, I'm going back. I'm Katie Ball for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note on the way out today, a chance to get away from the headlines and see what else was happening out there this week, courtesy of Brendan Noonan, Rico Galliano, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Delasi Michalis, web developer for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
I'm going to be talking about Gmail, which is Google's popular online email service.
Why, for any particular reason?
Well, they're well known for giving users a generous amount of space to store their email messages, almost unlimited. But one guy named Mike Montero is, we believe, the first person to run up against the limit.
Wait, he filled his Gmail account?
Exactly.
Did he try to, like, physically attach the entire state of Texas to one of his emails?
Or maybe he tried to attach a copy of Google's earnings for the last 10 years.
Chrissy Clark, sustainability reporter. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
So the Harvard Business Review reported on this poll from AskMen.com that says that 60% of young men, if they had the chance, would punch their work colleagues in the face.
Is it wrong of me to think that that seems like a small number?
Well, considering that I'm looking at you right now and I work with you, I'm a little bit worried. How old are you, Rico?
Alas, not that young. Old enough that the only people I want to punch in the face are young men.
Yes.
For being young.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter for Marketplace. What's your story?
Brendan, soap operas are on the decline.
Really?
I know. As The World Turns got replaced, Guiding Light's been canceled. There are only six soaps left. That's like less than half of what there were in the 70s.
How do you know the industry's really dying? Couldn't it be the industry's identical twin? And we're going to find out next year the industry's still alive?
Yes, in a dramatic comeback. It just had amnesia.
There is oh so much more that Rico and Brendan can do. It's all on their podcast, The Dinner Party Download, it's called. And there is a link on our website, which is called marketplace.org. And on a Friday, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow shaved off 16 points, a 10% close to 10,303, down 3.3% the Dow was. The NASDAQ also lost 16 points. That is 0.75% to end the day at 2173, 5% for the week. The S&P 500 dropped 4 points, 0.4%, 10,079, off 3.8% for the 5 days that was. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, what happens when Social Security becomes your only source of income?
What you see is what you get. If you're looking for a rich old lady, you ain't going to get one.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will be back here on Monday. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.